of our members, I'm going to temporarily open a public hearing on House Bill 3036 and call Representatives March and Jensen up.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve March. I represent District 46 in the center of Portland, and I also serve on the board of Hollywood Senior Center and have a graduate certificate in gerontology and have taught at the Institute on Aging at Portland State University. And I reference this in that one of the things we've learned over time is that Oregon Project of Independence has been one of Oregon's premier programs aimed at serving our elderly. Oregon has been at the forefront of taking care of our seniors from community-based care, foster care homes, assisted living, Project Independence, and the Senior Property Tax Deferral Program, all aimed at keeping seniors in a community-based or home-like settings. And the bill before you, with its accompanying amendment, will protect OPI. Firstly, it follows the nexus setting aside for OPI any excesses, and I use that term loosely. Basically, revenues in above what the senior property tax deferral program needs at the moment to operate, and any of the interest that that the senior property tax deferral program would generate in excess of their needed reserves would roll into the OPI fund. As you may recall, during the special sessions, including Special Session 6, we tapped that Senior Property Tax Deferral Fund for over $25 million. We took 20 in one session and 20 and another five. So we took 25 out of it. There's no reserves more than that are needed right now. But we rolled that money into the general fund, and this money came from seniors, and it should be dedicated back to seniors, and that's why the amendment before you, if you take a look, it's a very simple amendment, and if anybody got a dollar, it takes the dollar away and replaces it with a $13,730,000 check from the state general fund to the OPI fund. So,
Mr. Chair, the money.
Exactly.
Mr. Chair, Representative March presented the dollar. Can he present the $13 million as well?
That's in a check, sir.
We should be able to send this straight to the floor then, right?
No problem. I think we're ready. Obviously, this amount's what's been budgeted to OPI in the distant past, combined with what's in the governor's budget, this would actually fund OPI at the probably where it needs to be. We have obvious greater need today, and with that, I want to thank my friend Representative Jensen for coming down here today. I didn't get a chance to have him sign on to this, but we signed on to some other bills together at the FBI, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here in front of you and testify on OPI. For the record, my name is Bob Jensen. I'm state representative from House District 58, which includes the great metropolitan areas of Hermiston and Pendleton and some of the smaller cities surrounding those two metropolitan areas. OPI has been one of my projects since my first session here, and at least two of the members of the committee will remember that first session that I was here, and this was a priority bill at that time. OPI was a priority bill at that time. The governor had cut the budget on OPI. I had a bill that would have restored the funding to the 93 level adjusted for inflation and caseload. I would suggest to the members of the committee that the $13 million that Representative March has And at $13 million, I just rounded off. I can't deal in numbers that high. So, but that Representative March has proposed to you is small compared to what that would be had we kept funding OPI at the rate that we were in the early 1990s. And colleagues, members of the committee, I would like to remind you of what I think is one of the very famous ads that appeared on television and on radio, I think some too. And if I'd really had my thinking cap on yesterday in preparation for this committee, I would have stopped at one of the parts houses and auto parts houses and purchased a Fram oil filter. This is a very simple bill. It's an issue of pay me now or pay me more later. Because that's precisely what is going to happen if we don't fund OPI. We all know that none of us have the courage, or the courage is the wrong word, the cold heart that would be necessary to turn our senior citizens that are fragile and unable any longer to provide care for themselves out of the nursing homes and other facilities that they would have to be in earlier if it weren't for OPI. OPI saves us tens of thousands of dollars every month by keeping people out of extended care facilities. And as such, I make light of the $13 million. I think it's inadequate. I wish we could do more than that. And I would sincerely request that the committee move this bill and move the amendment in such a way that it would send a strong message down to Ways and Means, and we know that's where the decision ultimately is going to be made, but we need to send a strong message down to Ways and Means that we really do care about our senior citizens and that this is only a modest amount of what we actually need. But with the seniors, and we all recognize we live in difficult times right now. So we leave it in your capable hands and ask for your help and support on this bill. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you. Can you explain to me where the interest usually goes? It says that the interest would...
I'd be happy to. I understand your question. Currently, the Senior Property Tax Deferral Program pays for the property taxes for low-income seniors who qualify, and they are charged a simple 6% interest. That is simple, meaning it does not compound, so you're not paying interest on interest. But even at that simple 6%, the program was increasing in the amount of reserves it had. And that's why we were able to take a chunk out of their reserves. We took 20 and then another 5. So $25 million out of their reserves. And we put that money into the general fund. And they probably had excess reserves at that time. I mean, the program needs a certain amount of money to operate, just to keep paying those property taxes and such. But because of the interest growth, it had grown. And what I'm proposing is that when it gets to a point where they have greater reserves than they need for operation, that anything greater would roll into the OPI fund. We will have to fund the OPI fund with general fund because we've already taken that their reserves that they had beyond operations and used it in the general fund. So I'm saying we're going to backfill the general fund until such time as that's generating enough revenue.
Okay, so we're actually taking general fund money.
To start, originally I started the OPI fund, separate fund, with $1, we're replacing that with $1 from general fund, we're replacing that $1 with $13.7 million in general fund in the amendment. And then we've established a separate fund so we can find other ways of funding that fund as well. But the idea of having a separate fund is that it won't get tapped for other uses.
Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
If I could, just one quick thing. Normally, Representative Martin and I would have kept a chair between us make sure that the separation of parties was duly recognized before you, but on this, we do feel this is genuinely a nonpartisan
issue. I considered sending Representative Barker, as he does for experience in law enforcement, down to sit between you, but...
Thank you.
We are united on that.
Lee, do you and Senator George want to come up together?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, my name is State Senator Jerry George, representing District 12. Sometimes doing what is right brings together many diverse people. And one of the things that we're doing in Ways and Means, and I just left my committee to come down here and appreciate the opportunity to get in and get out of here quickly, we're all looking for dollars. And we're looking for dollars that we think should be moved into places that might be more beneficial, particularly for the most vulnerable members of our society. And I think this is the case where we're looking at an opportunity to set up a fund that we're not going to be raiding in the future. And with that, I very strongly support that. And also the Dash 1 amendments. The reason for that, if you look at the $13.7 million, you're up to the 1999 levels. It's a basically a minimum amount of money. And believe me, in my committee, we're looking for dollars. We're looking for dollars that can be moved. And you know the co-chairs have made it clear that that's what they're trying to do. This is something that I've supported because I believe it is efficient. As a conservative Republican, I believe in efficient government, but also that government must be compassionate where that compassion is needed, and that is with our senior population. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions and encourage your support.
Any questions? Senator, thank you very much. Lee.
Mr. Chair and distinguished members of the committee, my name is Lee Hazelwood.
Wait 1 second.
Okay.
Even though it's not true, we do look like brothers, don't we?
Yeah, I wondered if Senator George could explain this diversity comment a little bit more.
Before I begin my testimony, I will say that he's my younger brother. But
good shot, Lee.
Mr. Chair and distinguished members of the committee, my name is Lee Hazelwood. I'm a longtime advocate for seniors and people with disabilities. I'm also a former member of the Governor's Commission under the last three governors. I don't know whether that's an honor, but I thought it was. I come before you today to talk about my favorite program. I've been working on this program for over 20 years. I'm talking about Oregon Project Independence, which we normally call OPI. In your hands that I've handed out to you is the history of OPI, including the how and why it first got started. In 1973, while promoting a proposal which eventually became OPI, Governor Bob Straub said, and I'm quoting him, "It is, in my opinion, a disservice to place a man or woman in an institution when, with a little help, that person can remain in his or her home and community. For many, the lifelong dream of dignity, comfort, and independence in retirement has become a nightmare of dread. Instead, there is a cruel tarnish on their golden years." In 1975, Governor Bob Straub signed Oregon Project Independence into law. During the 20th anniversary celebration of Oregon Project Independence, former Governor Bob Straub and his wife attended the Governor's Commission annual meeting. During that meeting, he was given an award, and he also talked again about Oregon Project Independence. 20 years later, can you think of that? During the last regular session, the then Speaker of the House appointed a task force comprised of Democrats and Republicans to hold public hearings around the state to look at the impact of cuts to seniors and people with disabilities. Needless to say, the task force final report listed OPI at the top of the list. So I would like to say to you that many seniors are totally reliant upon the state's assistance to provide the necessary service they receive from Oregon Project Independence. For clients at or below the federal poverty level, they are not charged for any of their services. For those clients who are capable of paying for part of their services, they are charged according to a sliding fee scale. People with net incomes over 200,000% of the federal poverty level pay the full hourly rate for each service. So it's not a free service for a lot of people. Here are a few facts about Oregon Project Independence. More than 50% of the clients are at least 80 years old. This is the fastest growing segment of our society. More than 75% are living on Social Security and 40% are at or below the federal poverty level. The typical client is female, 75% of those, and lives alone, 69%. Oregon Project Independent programs help approximately 4,000 Oregonians each year. Our present Speaker of the House, Karen Minnis, in her opening address to the House of Representatives, spoke of building a budget that, among other things, would provide a safety net for vulnerable and less fortunate Oregonians. Oregon Project Independence clients are definitely in that category. Senator Kurt Schrader was quoted in the Monday, April 7, 2003 Oregonia saying that the co-chair's budget will emphasize programs for seniors and children. I highly agree with his comment on protecting seniors. And I have something to give each one of you, and I hope that you some way post it on your... And while she's passing out, I would like to read something that I've always kept on my wall at home. To his collection of tombstone epitaphs, our language man has added, "Remember, friend, as you walk by, as you are now, so once was I. As I am now, so you will be. So be prepared to follow me. Wait, that's not all. Beneath the foregoing, a passerby allegedly scrawled, to follow you, I'm not content till I find out which way you went." And this is something I've always kept on my wall at home. But I urge you, no, I beg you, please pass this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you. I'm willing to answer any questions.
Who questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Westman.
Maybe just a comment. Oregon is noted. It's one of the few distinctions I think we still maintain, or retain, I guess is the better word, in terms of the senior care we provide and the variety of senior care, the options available to seniors. And there are three people in this room, Dolores, Phyllis, and Lee, that have worked tirelessly towards that effort. And I cannot thank you enough, not only on behalf of myself and I'm sure the entire committee, but the innumerable seniors that have benefited from your tireless efforts here in the Capitol. Just thank you.
Thank you. And I might make one comment to Representative Monis Anderson. I happen to pick up the top property tax relief thing, and so I'd be happy to give this to you. The questions you were asking about are listed in here.
That'd be great.
Thank you.
Representative Belton.
Or pass that out to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to take this opportunity to thank my friend Lee Hazelwood, who is one of the most committed and dedicated advocates I've ever met in this process. You know, I worked as an aide last session, and I would frequently be called into Lee's office, which is the little area right outside the cubicle next to the copy machine. But we'd have wonderful conversations, and I thank you, Lee, for working so hard for Oregon Project Independence. So you're here every day, all day, working very hard, and seniors in Oregon are very lucky to have you advocating for their behalf.
Thank you. I thank all of the committee. Thank you very much.
going to call up Jim Davis, Dolores, and Ruth. Let's just...
We'll have a party, right?
We'll have a party.
Go ahead.
You're batting cleanup, Ruth, but you can come on up.
Oh, and I should have put Ruth in my... I didn't see you hiding back there.
Go ahead, Jim.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis, representing United Seniors of Oregon, Portland Great Panthers, Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities, and Save Oregon Seniors. We strongly support this legislation, and of course we strongly support the Oregon Project Independence and the development of this fund and the further funding of what has been a cornerstone program in our system. It really has provided a safety net for those who are near poor or lower middle income who don't qualify for other Medicaid services. It's serving, as Lee said, over 4,000 a year. As a gerontologist, I have worked within and advocated for the senior and disability system for the last 30 years, and we are very, very proud of this system and what it has done for seniors and people with disabilities. But we've been particularly proud of Oregon Project Independence and what it started back in the mid-70s and what it was able to establish in terms of the whole concept of community-based care for these populations. So anyway, we strongly support this and ask you to move it on to Ways and Means.
Thank you.
Good morning. Chair Cruz, members of the committee, my name is Dolores Hubert, and I come from Gresham, Oregon. I am the chair of the Health and Long-Term Care Committee of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. We strongly support this bill and the Dash 1 amendments. You know, OPI is usually the first thing to get cut, but it is the program that is the most successful at keeping the lowest costs. We don't want to see it go away. This needs to be a stable source of funding. The fees are based on a sliding scale, and it allows our senior citizens to participate in their care and to maintain their dignity. It also allows them just to be a part of the community. Even though they're old, it allows them to be part of the community. Lee is a hard act to follow, so I'm not going to go into any of the particulars, but we urge your support for this bill and the Dash 1 amendment. Thank you.
And we will be moving this bill on Dash 1 amendments. I'm fairly confident of that, but I thought it was appropriate that Ruth have the final word on this for reasons I'm sure she will be willing to expound upon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. And for your patience with those people who might be a little hard of hearing in their older age. I'm 78, and when Project Independence was begun, I was doing a master's in public administration and gerontology and commuting to Salem. That's when I was about 40. And I didn't intend to become the historian for some of these programs. But here I am. It has many beginnings, but I'm here really to promote very much, Mr. Chair, your intent that this bill goes straight to Ways and Means. And if I may, I'll read a brief testimony with the idea that technical information on OPI has been variable over the years. And I believe that we have a great opportunity at this time to develop and look at some of the data that is going along with OPI. It would I welcome it because it offers good opportunities in the next month or so to review the policies behind the program and the effectiveness of the program. It appeals to me because we've known from the beginning that it has needed a match for general fund dollars, especially in certain economic times. And I salute the tenacious and the persistent and the successful advocacy efforts for each of the last 9 sessions to save the program without a match. And the legislators who have, from all political sides, recognize that OPI is a unique workhorse, a unique workhorse in the range of services that we've offered. It's important to older people at all income levels who do not need institutional care after experiencing sudden problems, that is, strokes or heart problems or bad falls, three of the most prevalent calamities that befall senior population, or who have accumulated even more slowly some dependence on others. People in middle income and upper incomes can experience a stroke in such a way that if that stroke is disabilitating for a while, they will need some help in recovery. During that recovery, without home care, a family can become nearly destitute because of the cost of uncovered care, or from another standpoint, they will unnecessarily be institutionalized without that need. At this time, there is an increasing need for what we called at the beginning of this program, cookers and copers, or some people said substitute sisters. And it was alive and well and born at the time when, of course, we had no waivers. And the only alternative to the OPI program at that time was institutional care. And the provider community admitted to committees were quite sanguine about saying that 15 to 20% of people at that time in nursing homes did not need the services of a nursing home. There were many motivations for promoting OPI and seeing that it was launched. So if we're interested compassionately or economically or both, we must focus on home care and keep the focus there, despite the visibility or the strength of other kinds of provider services. Recovering independence at home is probable statistically, for a significant portion of older Oregonians who experience temporary or handicapping setbacks. Project Independence, with emphasis on independence, with service provided in home, is a recovery program in that sense. There have been, and there are now, several suggestions to match OPI general fund dollars with additional other funds, suggestions which might well be possible under the structure that was proposed and that was emphasized by Representative Marsh. I'd be pleased at some time to describe some of those matches in more detail. Some of them were introduced 10 years ago when, in fact, the economic climate was quite different, and the advocates were able to continue the program with the unmatched general fund. I would end my comments at this point with a pledge to be as helpful as I can to any or all of the members of the committee.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you all very much. I'm somewhat hesitant at this point. We got a late note up here that Ralph wants to testify on this, and I just don't know. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. 2 minutes? Well, come on up, Ralph.
Heard Mr. Chair Ralph in 2 minutes.
That's why I'm really interested in this myself.
See, might be historical.
Yeah, it might be historical.
Because I'm old. Mr. Chair, members of this wonderful committee, for the record, my name is Ralph Groner. I represent AFSCME. I'll say this as rapidly as possible since I'm being timed. I co-chaired the committee that created Project Independence. That's not a big deal, except Congress had said we pick a state in America that has done more with seniors to help us with our Medicare, Medicaid programs in this country. Bob Packwood sent it out. We got the grant, the state did, to our speakers. I co-chaired with Bill McCoy. We hired young Jim Davis, young Ron Wyden right out of law school, and a young man who became Alan Manuel, a Rhodes Scholar. We wrote Project Independence. It's not only helped Oregon, but it's helped the United States since it was a federal grant. I'll leave it at that. Only to say, as a union person, I would lose significant amount of members in Mid-Willamette Valley, Multnomah County, so I do have a special interest. So it's the people who work in the Project Independence arena are my employees, And so I speak for that, but I would say that I hate to see us cut programs that do, in fact, save money in this state, and it has saved many, many millions of dollars, and cut those. Let's keep it going with an amount that it allows this program to go in a wonderful fashion that it has through the years. It's proven itself. I don't want to see us kill this wonderful, wonderful preventative program. That's basically all I have to say, and I want to thank Ben Westland for timing me. That's helped me. I now need to catch my breath. Thank you.
Happy to.
93 seconds, Mr. Chair. Pretty good.
Thank you.
I'm impressed. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3036. Open a work session on House Bill 3036. Entertain a motion on the -1 amendment. Representative Tomei moves the -1 amendment to House Bill 3036. Any objections? Seeing none, it's adopted. Representative Tomei?
I move House Bill 3066 to the floor of the House.
3036
to the floor with the due pass recommendation with the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Yep.
Good job.
Okay. Yeah, I can't believe I've been doing that wrong all these years. But we learned that yesterday,
yes,
didn't we?
Did.
Representative Tomei moves House Bill 3036 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. You know, that just sounds backwards
to me.
Does. It really does. It's going to Ways and Means. Any discussion?
Just one comment.
Yes.
And I don't like to be the fly in the ointment because I love OPI and I have worked with many, many, many seniors who are on OPI. But I'm hoping that other organizations aren't going to start tying up general fund money so that we don't have any other money for our public safety, for our education. And this is what we're doing. We are tying up some general fund money. And I'm just making that point.
Well, and I'd also point out that actually we're making a recommendation to Ways and Means on what they should spend general fund dollars on. But the ultimate decision is in that subcommittee. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd just like to comment that while this is an excellent, I think, expenditure of dollars, even more important is the program that keeps people at home instead of warehousing them. And I support OPI in the strongest of terms. Thank you.
Any other discussion?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Being a senior, which few of you are, I fully support what my colleague from Representative Barker is saying. We desperately need to help people be in their own homes, and I'm going to strongly support this bill.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Aye. Aye. And just for the record, Representative Anderson wasn't hesitant. He just had a senior moment. I'm sorry, I couldn't resist that one.
I can't remember. What's your name?
House Bill 3036, having received the constitutionally required majority, is declared passed. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 3036. And the committee will stand at ease for a moment. for your patience. We are going to not go into work session at this point in time on 2964. We will reschedule it, and so I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3066. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3066, as you recall, directs the State Commission on Children and Families to establish strategies to improve the quality, stability, and safety of child care through compensation linked with professional development to child care providers. It establishes the CARES Child Care Professional Development Account. When we received testimony, we also had an amendment, V-2, I believe I have, yes, the -2, which encompasses points of what I just spoke to. But we did receive the fiscal impact statement from Legislative Fiscal Office on the -2 amendments. We do have an impact statement. It was the intent of the proponents to try and minimize the fiscal impact, to rescind the Ways and Means referral. However, since we do have a statement from the department saying that the likelihood that service reductions will be made within the Commission on Children and Families for the 2003-05 biennium, it is unclear what its ability would be to take on additional requirements related to this bill. The source of any funding to support the child care strategies is unspecified, and any additional monies received by SCCF should be considered within the overall context of the state budget.
And, so committee, I have been instructed, because there's uncertainty here, to go ahead and move it, but send it to Ways and Means so that it's viewed within the scope of that book of business. So I would entertain a motion on the -2 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move the -2 amendment.
Representative Westland moves the -2 amendment to House Bill 3066. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, -2 amendment is adopted. Representative Westland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 3066 as amended to to the floor with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. Representative Westland moves House Bill 3066 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion?
Yes.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to be on record that I really do not like to pick one model and say, hey, this is the way you have to, this is what you have to implement, because I keep thinking that I know the CARES child care model is wonderful, but there are others out there. I can't say whether they are better or worse, but that's my only hesitancy. There's no way I'm not going to support the bill, but I am concerned that there are maybe other models out there that a community would rather have rather than the CARES child care model. Thank you.
Any other discussion? Seeing none, call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 3066, having received their constitutional majority, is declared passed. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 3066 and open the public hearing on House Bill 3157. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 3157 modifies dental hygienist definition. It authorizes dental hygienists to perform oral health screenings and other procedures determined by the Oregon Board of Dentistry to be within the scope of the dental hygiene school curricula, postgraduate training programs, and continuing education courses. It modifies the initial education requirements for limited access permitted dental hygienists, declares an emergency to be effective on passage. We have several requests for amendments. At this point in time, all we have received back from Legislative Council are the -1s that should be attached with your packet, but I do believe folks will be speaking to the concept of other amendments that are yet to come.
Okay. Paul Cosgrove. Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Paul Cosgrove representing the Oregon Dental Hygienists Association, and thank you for having a hearing on this bill, and thank you, Representative Cruz, for introducing it. As it was dropped on the last day of dropping, it didn't have the little phrase request at the request of the Oregon Dental Hygienists Association. This bill does three things, and the testimony I'm handing out to you mentions those in greater detail. I will go over each of those three major subjects and then maybe highlight a few of the specific words in the bill that accomplish those results. First, it permits dental hygienists who perform oral health screenings at schools and other locations, and dental hygienists are currently licensed and within their scope to provide those services. It permits them to communicate the results of those findings to the patient or patient's parent or guardian. I've attached to my testimony one of the common screening forms used in Oregon. This one is developed by the Health Network for Rural Schools. You can see that this screening form covers a couple of subjects, including a vision screening and then a dental screening. And you can see that in the choices down on the dental screening, this is a form that was considered by the Board of Dentistry. It talks about no obvious cavities were found, your child has obvious cavities and should see a dentist. In each case, there's a follow-up with a dentist. This is the kind of service that dental hygienists and, frankly, some public health nurses and school health nurses currently provide at schools. The issue that this bill addresses is that this information, these results in this kind of a form or a similar form, can be given to the parent or the parent's guardian to encourage them to see a dentist, and in some cases to point out the urgency of the need to see a dentist. Carla Gertz, to my left, is a person who works in nursing homes. She has a limited access permit. She has also, in this last year, screened over 1,000 kids at 18 different schools. So if there are questions about how this process currently works and what 3157 doesn't change it, she's an excellent person to address that. The second thing is it allows the Board of Dentistry to permit dental hygienists to perform new procedures as technology and oral health care practices develop. If the board finds that the skills are included in dental hygiene program curricula or continuing education classes. This is a change that was made 4 years ago to the definition of dentistry, where we added this same kind of a clause. And you can see the clause that I'm talking about on lines 15 through 18 of the bill. And you can see that that same clause is included in the definition of dentistry on page 1 in lines 28, 29, 30, and then at the top of page 2, lines 1 and 2. So what it does is it updates the definition of dental hygiene to allow, as the profession and new technologies, which we hope continue to be developed, and as new school curricula, we can integrate those technologies into the training of dental hygienists, it allows the board to add those within the scope of practice. That's the second thing. The third thing deals with limited access permit hygienists, and as you know from prior testimony on one of the Board of Dentistry bills, these are the people who are allowed, after additional training and education, to practice independently in certain locations, commonly nursing homes and other kinds of facilities, as well as in school settings, and to perform dental hygiene. They're not authorized to perform anything other than dental hygiene. They just do it independently if they've had this additional training. A number of years ago when this was implemented in the statute, there were a couple of changes that we see now that need to be made in these initial education requirements, and I'll just briefly summarize those. One is, as originally written, all this training had to be classroom, meaning it had to be face-to-face with an instructor. Well, no one in the dental profession at this point is required to have that kind of face-to-face. We acknowledge that distance learning and all kinds of other educational opportunities are appropriate for education. And I don't think that's a controversial issue, but we're deleting the word classroom in order to allow that these education courses could be taken through distance learning, an issue very important, especially for people who live in rural communities far away from the schools. The second issue has to do with where the who offers the education. The current law requires that all these courses be taken at a Commission on Dental Accreditation accredited program, which means a dental hygiene program or a dental school. There are only those programs only exist in Portland metropolitan area, Eugene, and Klamath Falls at OIT. And so people in other parts of the state, southwest Oregon, central Oregon, and eastern Oregon, it's difficult for them to take time from their days and their practices to go and travel to one of those locations for their courses. With an agreement with the Board of Dentistry, by the way, who supports the whole bill, we've decided it makes sense to allow that some of these courses, which deal with medical and healthcare issues and pharmacology, ought to be, if approved by the board, be allowed to be taken at nursing schools. And nursing schools are far more prevalent geographically within the state, eastern Oregon, southern Oregon, and at some of the community colleges elsewhere in Oregon. There are a couple of other minor changes in the limited access permit initial education. We wanted to make sure that the CPR courses that are required could be taken not just at a CODA-approved school, Council on Dental Accreditation, but frankly in the communities where these people live, the Heart Association, the Red Cross, or the Emergency Services Bureau Fire Department may be the more appropriate and convenient place to take that same CPR course. And we've made it clear that in the Dash 1 amendments, we're talking about the CPR course for health professionals. It's a higher level than just I would be taking if I were going to take CPR. So that's what the bill does. It is supported by the Dental Health Coalition, by the Oregon Dental Hygienists Association, and by the Board of Dentistry. And as I've testified, you have in front of you the Dash 1 amendment. They make some of the clarifications that I just mentioned in the language of the bill, and they also address some additional clarifications on the dental assistant supervision issue that you heard last week that we've now negotiated with the Oregon Dental Association and that will be incorporated in House Bill 2240, which has already left this body. We wanted to make sure they were also put in the agreed version in this bill as well. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and Carla Gertz is here to answer any of the questions that you may have on what the details of this bill are. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are you aware of any other amendments that are floating?
Mr. Chair, I have talked to Jane Myers as recently as yesterday afternoon, and I know that she had talked about an amendment. My understanding is that there is another amendment on the screening issue. It doesn't prohibit dental hygienists from doing screenings, but it would add in dental assistants and use a little bit different words to do that. We don't have a position on that. I think the Board of Dentistry may have a position on whether dental assistants are appropriately trained to do this kind of screening. And then it, as I understand that it was at least proposed as an amendment, I don't know if it's come out, it would not permit the limited access permit hygienists to take some of their coursework as approved by the board at nursing schools or these other locations that we're talking about. It would continue to require them to come to a Council on Dental Accreditation dental hygiene school in the Valley or in Klamath Falls. And, of course, that is a real concern to us. The whole point of making that change was to have some accessibility for rural Oregonians who want the limited access permit, who want to be able to do those services. And those services are desperately needed in those communities. Okay. But I haven't seen a specific LC draft amendment.
We'll ask the questions of another testifier. Do you have anything you want to add? Or
no, other than I would encourage your support of the amendments and the bill as it has been presented. I have practiced as a limited access permit hygienist since 1998 when I first got my permit. And I was in the nursing home prior to that, under the general supervision with the dentist that I currently still collaborate with. But I think one of the biggest things that my colleagues have said is the difficulty in obtaining the permit with the way the requirements are now stated. People that are in the eastern part of the state must come to Portland or at least to the Willamette Valley to get the courses, and it really does put a burden on them. Those that have done it, you know, have gotten their permits, but I think that we have many out there that would really like to get their permit, but there are just too many barriers for, you know, because of the cost and the distance and everything. So I would encourage the support of the amendments and the bill.
Can you give us your name for the record, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. Carla Gertz. I apologize.
Thank you. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So tell us some about the education that you would envision if this bill were to pass that the hygienists could take advantage of.
Well, currently there is a listing of required courses, and we've just modified them slightly or requested that they be modified slightly to incorporate the fact that in the last session the settings were expanded to include children, you know, settings in schools and preschools. Before, it was basically disabled and geriatric folk. And so that is a part of it. But the courses, basically allowing them to take them either through distance learning or through a program that's accredited by another accrediting agency, such as a nursing school or, say, this pharmacology school at Oregon State or something to that effect, it would make it easier for people to access the courses.
Well,
so, I mean, the topics are already in the statute.
So tell me something about the distance learning. How would that work?
Well, when there's a course, there are dental hygiene education programs that have distance learning. They have their didactic courses through communication with them. I was at a school in Wisconsin that had three different sites, and they were actually having their didactic course in dental hygiene theory over the TV monitors, and they had interaction that way. So there are courses like that. There's also the opportunity to have courses over the internet. I don't know how the classroom. We want to get rid of defining the classroom with four walls. Looking at how we can better. I mean, when you can get a master's degree off the internet or through the internet educational system, I think it's wonderful. But it's not going to. You know, we have our clinical experiences when we're in dental hygiene school.
Mm-hmm.
What we're doing is expanding our capabilities as far as being able to deal with the people that are in limited access settings, i.e. children or adults that are disabled or geriatric.
If I can follow up. Mm-hmm. I can imagine that some people might be critical of an educational experience that wasn't face-to-face,
mm-hmm.
that it was something that you got on a video
mm-hmm.
or something of that nature. So how would you respond to that?
Basically, the kinds of courses that we're required to take, with the exception of CPR, they are didactic-type courses.
Okay.
So it really is not a hands-on. It's not like I'm going in to learn how to scale a tooth. I'm actually expanding my knowledge, for example, physical diagnosis. I could watch a video of a lecture given at an institution, for example, Oregon Health Science University School of Dentistry in the Continuing Education Department. Perhaps a course would be offered by Dr. Barton Johnson from Seattle, and I happen to have taken his course a few years ago. That can be videotaped, and they do that a lot to make it available to others. Previously, this has not been available to people seeking their limited access permit.
Mr. Chair, may I add one other item? Currently, the continuing education for dental hygienists and for dentists can be taken mm-hmm. through distance learning. This just means that the additional education for limited access permit dental hygienists is made consistent with the other opportunities that are already. And we have to do that because this particular statute said classroom. The other statutes just say continuing education and have been made flexible in that very way.
Great. I understand. Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, in your number one point in terms of the screenings, I think this may be answered by floating amendments, but in your mind, does this imply or is a de facto diagnosis go along with this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, no. The issue of diagnosis is one that is reserved to dentists, and the screenings, as I think you know and others probably know as well, that happen in school settings and elsewhere are generally without many or very many pieces of equipment. They're certainly without radiographs, x-rays that would be required for a diagnosis. They are the initial screening. The thing that I think we're most concerned of, and I've talked to a lot of dental hygienists who see people in school settings, and sometimes the parents or guardians don't recognize things that are very obviously wrong with the dental hygienist looking within the mouth. So to allow us to communicate those findings to the parent is you really need to see a dentist and see a dentist soon. There are major problems even though you haven't as a parent yet recognized those. So it's that kind of communication.
Let me ask you for the record several questions from the position of the Dental Hygienist Association. who has the final determination on the scope of activity of a dental assistant being supervised by a dental hygienist? Is it the supervising dental hygienist, or is it the dentist who supervises the dental hygienist and by delegation the dental assistant?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, what this bill does on that issue, and I'll be glad to answer your question, just tracks what you just did in 2240, so we're not making any additional changes here except the ones we've negotiated to clarify language that will be done on the Senate side. The supervision of the dental assistant in, I think, the situation you're asking about by a dental hygienist when the dentist is not there, obviously it's the dentist that sets the pattern of who can be practicing in his or her office with whom at what time. What it just means is that there is a dental hygienist who's performing dental hygiene services, and the assistant is allowed to do the instrument sharpening and the other things while the assistant is there with the dentist's permission assisting the dental hygienist. So the ultimate responsibility is clearly with the dentist who sets up his or her practice the way he or she feels it's appropriate.
Follow up. Since a dental hygienist practices dental hygiene under the supervision of a dentist, except in the limited access permit, does the dentist retain final authority and accountability for the scope of activity of a dental assistant being supervised by a dental hygienist?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes. In this office context, clearly it's the dentist's final authority and responsibility for all this. Thank you.
Okay. Follow up. One final. Under the new definition of dental assistant, which permits supervision by dental hygienist, can the dentist who supervises the dental hygienist limit the delegation of supervisory authority and accountability granted to the dental hygienist?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, of course, yes. Okay. And we expect dentists will sometimes greatly restrict it and sometimes less restrict it.
Right. Thank you.
Any other questions? No. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to call up Jane Myers, Oregon Dental Association. We have two others on the registration list, Dr. Allen and Joanne Bones. We'll call them up next. Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, Jane Myers representing the Oregon Dental Association. We did ask for an amendment to House Bill 3157, and I'm having a hand and gross measure passed out to you. I also am passing out this. It's a dental hygiene fact sheet because I think in order to understand our position and why it's an important bill to us, I think we have to let you know a little bit about dental hygienists and how they work as a team with the dentists in their offices. And this is a fact sheet from the American Dental Association where they did a look at the education of dental hygienists and the practice characteristics where they're working. And as you can see, 84% of the hygienists are trained in programs where there's an associate degree. So it's a two-year training program. Most, I think almost all of them are CODA, which is the Commission on Dental Accreditation, which is a national accrediting agency. They're all done by CODA, or pretty much all of them are done by CODA. There are some baccalaureate programs. As far as we know, there are no postgraduate programs in dental hygiene. The survey that the American Dental Association did shows that the average per hour salary is $26 an hour. This is back in 2000 when this information came out. When it was reported by the dentist, they were reporting $29.26 per hour for an average 24-hour work week. The statutes, if you look at the other state statutes compared to Oregon's, Oregon has a very liberal framework for dental hygienists. They work under general supervision here, which is not allowed in all states, and that means the dentist doesn't have to be in the office as long as the dentist is taking responsibility for the work of the employees. And that's the other point I want to make, is we're talking about, and why it's important to the dentist, is a relationship between employer and employees. And a lot of times the things that the legislature considers changing in the statute seem very small, but in the case of the amendments that the Dental Association and the Dental Hygienists Association made to the bill that came out of this committee, kind of had to smooth over some of the edges that didn't work for some models of employers with working with dental hygienists who were not their employees. So I just give that to you, as that is one of the reasons we stay so focused on this. You might think we'll be accused of micromanaging, but I assure you these are important issues to employers. Other states don't allow local anesthesia to be delivered by dental hygienists, and Oregon does and has for a long time. Also, nitrous oxide, which is a form of anesthesia. They can use high-speed hand pieces to polish amalgams here. That's not widely done in other states. They can also administer and dispense antimicrobial solutions, which help people avoid periodontal disease. They can apply temporary soft lines to full dentures, and they also can work without supervision under the limited access permit, which is a special kind of arrangement in this state that was an agreement with the Dental Hygienists and the Association and the Oregon Dental Association back in 1997. The legislature put it into law. And we're fine with that, but I just want to point out there are some real differences about the dental hygiene profession in the state of Oregon, and the statutes are pretty liberal about how they will work in what settings. The other thing about that I want to point out is it is a well-compensated profession. There is a very dentists frequently report shortages in being able to hire dental hygienists who would be available to work. They can pretty much dictate their hours of work. And I think you all probably have some experience with dental hygiene and dental offices, and the dentists feel very fortunate when they can keep the same dental hygienist employed for a long period of time because their patients are more comfortable with that. So what I'm telling you is there is a short pool of dental hygienists to draw from, and it causes some problems for dental offices in recruiting them. There are frequently liability issues and risk factors. I mean, we have people practicing without supervision in their own businesses who may also be working for dentists, and we sometimes run at least the thought there's a fear of risk of if you have workers' comp injury or compounding carpal tunnel syndrome in your independent job and you're working for an employer who also has to carry workers' comp on you, we do run some risks, and the dentists are willing to run those risks, but I want to point them out to you. They're important to my folks. Also, there's a longstanding team effort concept in the dental office, and that includes dentists, the dental hygienists, and the dental assistants. And the dentists are sensitive to that. They aren't able to compensate dental assistants quite as highly as they do dental hygienists. They're beginning to have problems drawing dental assistants, getting enough trained personnel, and we've heard reports of that too. And we sometimes, I mean, one of the things that I ran into this last weekend at the Oregon Dental Convention was in a conversation with some folks from the Dental Assistants Association, saying they didn't think the Board of Dentistry listened to some of their concerns, and they were rather upset about being supervised by hygienists. They don't all have the same training. But, you know, we've assured them that we've taken care of that in the other bill. But I want to point out to you that slops over into relationships in a small office where you have people who may feel, and this has been reported to me, that they are not treated as well or comped as well as the hygienist. And we would like to avoid some of that. There are some quality of care issues and different standards of care issues that we are concerned about. I guess I'd better get to some of the things in the bill. We don't have a problem with changing that stuff about classroom hours. We understand limited for long-distance learning and support that part. The medical emergencies, the reason that's in the limited access permit, which that permit was designed to require some more education, dentists have to do 40 hours of continuing ed. Three of it has to be in medical emergencies. Dental hygienists have to do 24, three of which is in medical emergencies. And the limited access permit requires 36 hours of medical emergencies or of continuing ed, and the language in the law says 12 of them have to be in at least two of the courses listed in that list. One of them is medical emergencies. It was a boost to the continuing ed requirement because the agreement between the two associations was people who are going to be practicing without the supervision of a doctor, you know, someone who has 4 years of university training and 4 years of dental school to follow, need to have some boost to make sure that if the patient gets in any kind of medical situation that they've got background to handle it. So we are resisting taking that out of the list that they can draw from. We think that's really necessary, and we're not certain that they are doing that. They are required to do that under their dental hygienist license when they have this permit. So maybe we have to work that out some more, but that's why it's there. It was a boost. The accreditation by CODA, we're going to stand by that. We have a nationwide network that supports the Commission on Dental Accreditation as the standard for dental educators and their programs. And if we have to look at it some more, I mean, we'd be happy to try to do that. We're concerned that we don't want to encourage coursework that doesn't really prepare people to work out there without supervision. We asked for an amendment that I think you have on the back page, and what it does is it adds dental assistants to those who can do health screenings. We did ask for written protocols and screening protocols of the board on training. I received this from Chris McInturf and Barbara Neely from the Multnomah Education Service District, and this is about nurses doing dental screenings or how a dental screening is conducted where you have the dental van come to the school. And this is a protocol. It's very well designed, and it could be used by the Board of Dentistry. We would just like them to be able to have the assistants also participate. We think they're fairly well trained to do that. And we would like the protocols to be pretty clearly spelled out because, I mean, they're not using lay people to do these things. They're using people with training, and they have a requirement that the parents be notified of the results of the screening. And we would think that that would be appropriate because screening means recognizing gross problems, not, you know, really doing a diagnosis, as you heard before. So we're going to stand firm on that one, and let's see, did I cover everything? The definition, we're giving the scope of practice issues over to the Board of Dentistry to decide based on what's taught in school and what's taught in CE. We're resisting that. Yes, the legislature changed that for the dentist. It was based on a national model that was developed over quite a long period of time by the American Dental Association. Dentistry is a narrow field of medicine, but we now have dentists who also have medical degrees, dual degrees, it's called. We have 8 specialty areas in dentistry, which there are a lot of techniques, there are a lot of pieces of equipment like laser cutting tools that we were concerned to make sure we're always within the scope of the dentist. And that's why we had the legislature put that clause in there. Hygiene is a very narrow field of in their scope, and the board right now, the Board of Dentistry has quite a lot of authority to add to that. And we don't want to encourage more unnecessary rulemaking at the board. We find a lot of time spent doing rulemaking, and it's frequently about adding different kinds of procedures and such. I think the statute's pretty clear. It's pretty much the same statute that's in most of the states, and we would kind of like to keep some consistency in there and not get into areas of writing prescriptions. We've got doctors in the office. They write the prescriptions. And we don't want to get into any more fighting than we have to. We have some evidence of the Board of Dentistry getting, where one of the dentist members wanted to allow dental assistants to do rubber dams without having expanded function training, you know, so that particularly the endodontist didn't want their some of their tools to be aspirated, and a lot of resistance on the part of the dental hygienists on the board to giving that to the dental assistant. So we'll keep those within the Board of Dentistry, and we don't want to air problems here that we think are better resolved at the level of the dentist and the dental hygienist at the board working it out with the enthusiastic participation of both of their associations. So with that, that's why we're proposing a different amendment that you don't have right in front of you at the moment, but we ask for your consideration, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions that you have.
Any questions? Thank you, Jane. Gary Allen.
Good morning, Chair Cruz and members of the committee. My name is Gary Allen, and I'm a dentist licensed in Oregon, trained in Oregon, then the University of Oregon Dental School in 1973, and I am a member of the Oregon Dental Association. And I'd like to add that I also volunteer my time doing dental assessments in an early Head Start program in the Portland area, and I work alongside of many dental hygienists in that endeavor. And as a way of background, the silly mandated division of labor between very highly trained and competent dental hygienists and myself has always been a mystery to me. And I believe that House Bill 3157 with the Dash 1 amendments is a very conservative and moderate measure that, as it's already been explained to you, does many things. However, I would like to limit my comments to the issue of oral screenings and communication of the findings, because my passion is to improve access to care for the citizens of Oregon. And I think that utilization of dental hygienists to the full extent of their training and experience is an important to meet that end. To clarify perhaps some of the confusion regarding a oral screening, conducting an oral screening does not equate to a diagnosis, to rendering a diagnosis. The diagnosis of oral disease does not occur until all the findings of that screening are considered and a decision is made to the diagnosis. And I'd like to point out that dental hygienists who graduate from an accredited dental hygiene program receive an average of 2,000 hours of classroom study in academic subjects emphasizing basic and dental sciences. And this includes at least 600 hours of supervised instruction in preclinical and clinical skills. And as already been testified, the Commission on Dental Accreditation of the American Dental Association is responsible for accrediting those programs, and it requires that graduates of accredited dental hygiene programs must be competent in oral health assessment, and that encompasses medical and dental histories, vital signs, extra and intraoral examination, periodontal and dental examination, radiographs, and risk assessment. In addition to that, the American Dental Education Association, their list of competencies for entry into the profession of dental hygiene requires that dental hygienists must demonstrate the ability to systematically collect, analyze, and record data on the general, oral, and psychosocial health status. The document goes on to explain that this competency includes performing a comprehensive examination using clinical, radiographic, periodontal, dental charting, and other data collection procedures to assess the patient's needs. So I submit that by the virtue of their training and experience, dental hygienists are more than qualified to perform oral health screenings and to communicate those findings. And in fact, I would like to go on record as saying and stating that dental hygienists are qualified to do even more to improve access and the oral health of our citizens if we were not so provincial as a profession and would allow them the freedom to practice to the full scope of their training. I'd also like to point out that licensed dental hygienists in Oregon are accountable to the Board of Dentistry, for any unacceptable patient care delivered, and this bill would not change that fact. Allowing dental hygienists to perform oral health screenings as provided by House Bill 3157 and to communicate those findings would not put the public at risk, but it would improve access to care for the public, something that is much needed in Oregon as well as in many other states, and particularly in the rural areas of our state. So I strongly urge you to move House Bill 3157 with the -1 amendment by unanimous vote to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Joanne?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Seems like we were just here. I'm Joanne Bones, Executive Director for the Board of Dentistry. I'm not here to briefly say that the Board of Dentistry supports House Bill 3157 and the Board would support the -1 amendments. The Board believes that the changes provided in the bill provide the Board with flexibility in determining the scope of practice for dental hygiene as it can with dentistry, and that the changes to the limited access permit requirements are necessary for access to care for Oregonians. I would like to really briefly speak to Ms. Meyer's proposal to put back the requirement that all of the additional education for limited access be obtained from a CODA-accredited program. As Mr. Cosgrove stated to you, there are only 5 dental hygiene programs, CODA-accredited programs, in the state of Oregon. One of those is closing in 2 months. It's in Portland. The only other CODA-accredited program is in Klamath Falls. That really makes it very difficult for the hygienists who want to go into this independent practice and serve some of our more fragile populations in nursing homes and even school settings from obtaining, excuse me, I'm very nervous today for some reason, from obtaining the education that it takes to get the education. And really looking at it logically, those education courses that are required are in general medicine, physical diagnosis, pharmacology, oral pathology, patient management. For these people who already have 2 good solid years of education in dental hygiene, it only makes sense that they can still obtain additional education in those specialized areas from, for instance, the Walla Walla Nursing School or a program in Idaho or Portland State University. It doesn't necessarily have to come from a CODA-accredited school to be a valuable education for serving these populations. The change in the definition to dental hygiene, as I've already said, correlates with the same change that was made for dentistry and provides the flexibility that the board has in that arena. And we would like to see you support Senate or House Bill 3157 with the -1 amendments. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much. I am going to give an opportunity for more amendments to come on this bill, a very short window, and I would suggest that that we may end up with maybe 2 sets of amendments, because and I'll leave it to Jane and Paul and Joanne to see where they agree and where they don't disagree, and let's separate those into different amendments if there is disagreement. So it's very clear to this committee as to what's what, and also so we don't have to send out for different amendments. So, and expedite the process, please. And so we will bring this back when we've got a chance to get a dash, whatever it turns out to be. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3157. You know, I think next meeting committee is the last time for these tap hearings, but here we go.
I had to do them in Representative Westland's committee, and so I'm really getting burnt out on TAPS. But anyway, open public hearing on House Bill 2700. Close public hearing on House Bill 2700. Open public hearing on House Bill 2834. Close public hearing on House Bill 2834. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2889. Close public hearing on House Bill 2889. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2919. Close public hearing on House Bill 2919. Open the public hearing on House Bill 3285. Close public hearing on House Bill 3285. Open the public hearing on House Bill 3502. Close public hearing on House Bill 3502. Open the public hearing on House Bill 3585. Close public hearing on House Bill 3585. And with no other business come before the committee, we are adjourned.
Thank you.